My name is Kate Manchester, and I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe and host of the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network. I am a member of a community of 55 publishers, Edible Communities. That's my community. And together, we create editorially rich, community-based local food publications in distinct culinary regions throughout the United States and Canada. We connect consumers with family farmers, growers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds, and we believe that every person has the right to affordable, fresh, healthful food on a daily basis. We are a for-profit, member-driven corporation. We are individuals who own our own publications. We're local food advocates and residents of the communities we publish in. It's a business model that not only supports our values, but also preserves the integrity of our member publications in the communities we each serve. On today's show, we'll be talking with Deborah Madison and her husband, Patrick McFarlane, about their new book. It's called What We Eat When We Eat Alone. It's published by Gibbs Smith Publishing. Later, we'll be talking with Heidi Eleftheriou of Heidi's Raspberry Farm in Corrales, New Mexico. In the meantime, we have some food for thought from, inspired today by a fellow Edible Vineyard publisher. Her name is Alice Burlow, and Alice is a new publisher, new to our community, and she publishes Edible Vineyard in Martha's Vineyard. Alice sent a notice to our listserv today, and it's about the USDA and state agriculture agencies are creating a nationwide location ID system for all livestock on all farms and ranches, regardless of the size or numbers of animals. It's called the NAIS, the National Animal ID System. And the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance is leading the fight to save family farms and individuals from this expensive and unnecessary, or we think unnecessary, government regulation. So the National Animal ID System, the NAIS, poses a serious threat to small farmers and ranchers and livestock owners and companion animal owners, whether they're organic or conventional or small or large, and whether or not they're involved with animals for business or for pleasure. So if it's made mandatory, every person, even a person with just one horse, one cow, one chicken, a pig, a goat, a sheep, virtually any other livestock animal on their premises, will be required to register their homes and property into a database and subject their property and animals to government surveillance. Under the current plans, each animal would have to be ID'd and physically tagged, in many cases with radio frequency tags or microchips. So factory farms of chickens and swine would be able to identify whole groups of animals with one number, but most regular farmers and individuals would have to identify each animal individually. So any events in the animal's life would have to be reported to a government agency within 24 hours. And all of this information would be kept in a database by the state government or private companies. And while the federal government will have the right to access these databases whenever it wants. So the NAIS system is voluntary right now in most states, and there are no federal regulations. But the USDA has stated that it wants every single person who owns even just one animal to be involved by 2009. The USDA is funding mandatory and coercive programs in some states, and the program is likely to continue expanding unless Congress and state legislature and you out there put a stop to it. The NAIS, again, doesn't distinguish between large corporate factory farms and small family farms, pleasure horse owners, or, you know, your grandma who has a few laying hens. It has the potential to drive small and medium-sized farmers and ranchers out of business, increasing the consolidation of our food supply into the hands of a few large multinational corporations. And the belief among small farmers and ranchers I've talked to is that the government is wasting your taxpayer dollars on a program that will lead to increased food prices and decreased quality. The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Foundation said that a cost-benefit study commissioned by the USDA themselves proves that the cost for small farmers to implement the NAIS system could put many of them out of business. And Acting Fund President Peter Kennedy states that the government's own numbers show that a small farmer will pay at least twice, and in some cases nearly three times, the cost per animal to participate in the mandatory NAIS, as will operators of large confined animal feed operations. Those are called CAFOs or CAFOs. So the cost for the animal ID system quoted in the study called the benefit-cost analysis of the NAIS system was released April 29th, ranged from $2.48 per animal for CAFOs with more than 5,000 cattle to upwards of $7 per animal for producers with less than 50 who don't currently tag their cattle. So Kennedy states that not only does the difference illustrate how unfair the NAIS will be, but we think the numbers themselves are substantially underestimated. And the reason he says that is that he points out that the study's unreasonably low estimate of what it would cost a small farmer to hire someone to read the tags, since many of them won't be able to afford to purchase the $1,000-plus electronic tag reading equipment. So Kennedy states that the government's time and labor costs for custom tag reading for animal ID systems are not grounded in reality. For instance, the study estimates that a small farmer could hire a third party to travel to his farm to do it for only $1.87 per animal. This estimate seems ridiculously low, especially for farms and ranches located in remote areas, Kennedy states. So Fund Board Member Taryn Mickle states that the first one speaks to the timely recovery of export markets after a disease outbreak, and the second says that traceability is necessary to participate in the global marketplace, she says. Neither of these matter to a small farmer who sells his beef to his neighbors on his farm or at a farmer's market. She reiterated the fund's position that implementing NAIS will do little, if anything, to improve animal health or food safety in the United States. So most of the health problems, she states, are the result of high-density CAFOs that concentrate thousands of animals in one location, while food safety problems begin at the slaughterhouse where NAIS traceability ends. For more information and to find out when and where you can find out about the listening sessions that the USDA is participating in, possibly in your community, and how you can make your voice heard, please visit www.farmandranchfreedom.org. That's farmandranchfreedom.org or farmtoconsumer.org. These listening tours the USDA plans to conduct in seven cities began on May 15th. So check it out, farmandranchfreedom.org, farmtoconsumer.org. We will be back in just a minute with Deborah Madison and Patrick McFarlane. And you're listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Kate Manchester of Edible Communities. And we would like to thank Hearst Ranch today for making this show possible.
Circumstance of
Deborah?
Yes.
Welcome. So we're here to talk to you today about what we eat when we eat alone, which is actually kind of a departure from most of the books, I think, that you've done in the past. And so I wanted to talk a little bit first about what your inspiration was for what we eat when we eat alone.
Well, in part it was Patrick, so he should probably talk about that because he's really the one who got it going.
I don't think Pat's here yet, but
okay. Well, I can talk about it. We were traveling quite a bit for a while with Old Ways Preservation and Trust, which is a think tank, and we were going to various countries to explore the Mediterranean diet. And Patrick, who is my husband and an artist, and interested in food but really not that interested, I think started to amuse himself and also maybe break the ice by just asking people on that trip who were largely food people what they ate when they ate alone. And he took notes, and he didn't say much about it, and he didn't have any plans, but one day I found them, and I thought, oh, this is so interesting what people do. This would make a great book. And I kept saying that year after year, and then finally he went in the house and he did some drawings, and he came out and said, would you want to illustrate it like this? And I said, oh, that's perfect. Now I'm on board. Let's do this together.
So, again, this is a real departure for you just in terms of, you know, what you're doing. I mean, you're blogging for Gourmet and Culinate. You've got, you're the author of 9 cookbooks. And
yes.
you generally write about food, and you're the author of Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. And I know that you're not necessarily a vegetarian, but this book is more conversational in tone, and you talk to quite a few people about what they eat when they eat alone, and tell me about some of the different things that that you discovered, say, between men and women.
Oh, men and women. Well, for one, they have a whole different language of cooking. We found that men tend to use sort of rougher and more energetic verbs, like they slap tortillas on the grill, or they slam something in a pot, or they stick spaghetti. Stick was a favorite verb. Stick tomatoes into a pasta sauce or something. Whereas women tended to be a little bit more refined, I think, in their verb choice. They tend to cut and dice and stir something. And, you know, they, as Patrick says, they cook. They
right.
don't have quite the brutal approach. However, it's you can never say anything for sure. There's always an interesting exception that pops up, like the woman who said she's stabs a steak. She stabs it and stabs it, but then she cooks it over a tender flame. So,
now, what kinds of things? I mean, what kinds of things do people eat when they eat alone? What were some of the? Give us, I don't know, some ideas about the range of.
Oh well, the range is enormous because on the one hand, you have foods that are completely non-shareable. They're just weird things, you know. They're secret foods. They're foods you would never serve to somebody else. In fact, you'd be hard pressed to make recipes out of them. For example, quite a few people mentioned things like saltines and milk, or oyster crackers and coffee, or matzah and coffee, some form of a dried crumbly thing in a hot liquid. A really gross one was margarita mix poured over bread, or a sandwich made out of last night's leftover spaghetti and salad. I mean, these are things that we might do, but we certainly wouldn't invite somebody to join us at the table. And at the other extreme, we had had people who were extraordinarily civilized, who loved to cook for themselves, and for whom the fact that they were alone made no difference whatsoever. They paused, they made a beautiful meal. Sometimes they were even complicated meals, like one bartender mentioned a flank steak that he stuffed with chopped mushrooms and bacon and cheese, and then rolled it up and grilled it. And, we made it. It was delicious. Of course, it served about six people. But again, men differ from women in that they seem to be very happy to eat off of the same thing all week long, you know, whereas that might not be so true of a woman.
That would not make me happy at all. In fact, I love leftovers.
No, me
leftovers.
Neither. To a certain extent, yes, but I have to have a little variation in there. But in between, there were really quite a few wonderful dishes that I made into recipes just on the basis of what people said. For example, there was one fellow who said he always made a green penne with broccoli and potatoes. And so I made this dish, and I found that what made it green is all the little broccoli pieces start to come loose as they cook with the pasta, and you end up with this beautiful green coating and nubbins of broccoli, and then the little bite of potato and the contrasting with the texture of the pasta. A really lovely, lovely dish. Oh, my gosh, there were lots of things. Polenta with braised greens or sautéed tomatoes over toast. One woman recalled, she said when she was alone, she went back to foods that were from her German past, and mm-hmm. she loved mashed potatoes with pickled herring, drizzled with sour cream and caramelized onions. Huh. And I thought that sounded good, so I made it, and it was absolutely
good. And
delicious.
And I guess that's my next question is, do you think that when people eat alone, do they tend to go back to things, those comfort foods of their childhood, or is it something else altogether?
Well, I think that they often do. In fact, you, Kate, were one of the people that I asked this question to, and you immediately brought up being from Rhode Island and how when you were alone, your taste really brought you back to the sea and the East Coast and how you wanted fish, but that if you couldn't get that, then Johnny Cakes was a pretty good second. So you're a very good example, I think, of somebody who thinks about some food from their past. I know that Patrick is very fond of pimento cheese, which his mother used to make. This isn't something I grew up with at all, so it wouldn't have even had occurred to me. But yes, I think to some degree that's true.
I think that, I know, first of all, I don't like to eat alone.
Mm-hmm,
so
me either.
That's, you know, when I do eat alone and I think about that meal all the time, to me that brings back memories. And the actual complete meal was pan-fried flounder. My grandfather was a fisherman, so he would bring fresh fish and grandma would dip it in a little egg batter and sometimes a little cornmeal and flour, and she would pan-fry the flounder, but we always had it with Johnny Cakes.
Oh.
And the Johnny Cakes, again, the Johnny Cake, it's very specific. It's Kenyan cornmeal. It's usually a white cornmeal, and you make a little batter with either hot milk or hot water, and they're like griddle cakes. You put them on a hot griddle, and then you always serve it with butter, and it's got to be maple syrup. We always had them with maple syrup, so it was just that kind of combination of flavors, but just the Johnny Cakes alone can conjure up
yes.
that memory, that taste
memory. I love
the
way you're being very specific when you say that it's served with syrup always and it's maple syrup. And people were amazingly specific sometimes about a brand of something they used or how something was cut, you know, that they really had it in mind that it had to be a particular way. But your speaking reminds me of one of the women who is on the video that we made for YouTube talked about how when she ate alone, she sometimes chose to eat something that conjured up the memory of a person if she happened to be thinking about her mother. And her mother loved roasted sweet potatoes. She would make roasted sweet potatoes and be thinking about her mother. And another woman had a similar story about her grandmother, who always used to make salmon cakes with a salad with Russian dressing. And she used to serve them on a Dove's plate, a plate that came out of a box of Dove soap. I don't even know if that exists anymore. But her memory of that plate with the black rim and the red rose in the middle and the salmon cake and the Russian dressing, she says even today she still occasionally makes that kind of in memory of her grandmother.
That's amazing. We're talking with Deborah Madison, who, with her husband Patrick McFarlane, is the author of What We Eat When We Eat Alone. And we're going to take a short break and come right back. Patrick McFarlane will be joining us. With Deborah Madison and Deborah's husband, Patrick McFarlane, sometimes known as Mr. Madison. Patrick is an award-winning journeyman painter and graphic designer. His fine art has been shown in New York, San Francisco, Houston, Scottsdale, Santa Fe. He works right here in Santa Fe. He's the creator of Pat's Downtown Club, featured on CBS Sunday Morning. You can view more of Patrick's work at McFarlaneOil.com. That's McFarlin Oil, McFarlaneOil.com.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi there, Pat.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing really, really well. So we're talking about the inspiration for the book with you and Deb, and it turns out that you were actually the inspiration for this. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know if I was the inspiration, but I was there. I was there at the beginning because over a period of years, Deborah and I traveled to Europe with a culinary think tank based in Boston, Old Ways Preservation and Trust. And this was a large group of culinary professionals, chefs, food writers, importers, scholars, and the like. And during these travels, I began asking people, what do you eat when you eat alone? And I took notes. But there was no plan of any kind at that time, no plan to make a book for sure.
And then Deborah found your notes.
Yeah, Deborah found the notes, and she said, maybe we have something here.
Maybe we have something here. Now, Patrick, you have done all of the illustrations for the book, and I really, really like the illustrations. It just adds an element of fun to what's an already very intimate look inside people's very private lives. I mean, I think what we eat when we eat alone is a very private thing for most of us. And if you look at some of these recipes, potato and green chili stew and sardines on toast and, eating in bed and all the different elements, different people doing different, have just different habits and different things that they do by themselves, things that they eat by themselves. It's deeply personal and intimate. But your illustrations are really, really fun, and I imagine you had a really good time doing the illustrations.
Oh, I had some fun, and it's like any kind of art adventure. Some come easy, and some are, a bit of a pain.
Uh huh. What do you eat when you eat alone when Deb's not around?
Oh, I eat some version of a panini usually.
You make your own panini?
At the studio, I have a little panini maker, and I make a spinach and Gruyere cheese panini, or fontina, a little salt and pepper, Dijon mustard, maybe some roasted bell peppers in there, cut into strips out of a jar,
Now, I heard, and actually it's in the book, but Deborah and Pat one of you, can you describe the meal that Pat would make to you? Because I thought this was such a beautiful and intimate peek into your life.
Oh, well, that's when we departed into the realm of seduction and food, because we don't always want to eat alone or be alone, and sometimes food plays such an important role in inviting somebody into our lives, whether it's for a day or a night or for a lifetime. So we were thinking about meals that we had prepared for each other when we first met, and they were pretty disastrous, actually. The first meal I made for Patrick, not knowing anything about his food taste, it was all foods that he really didn't care for and couldn't eat. And he made a dish of fried okra about 5 in the morning for me, you know, and I was rather touched that this was a way of sharing his southern background.
Oh, how seductive.
So I wouldn't
that?
Consider it a very seductive food. But we later came up with a meal that after 20 years of marriage would be, you know, really our own meal. And it may not make any culinary sense to anybody else, but it would to us.
And that meal
would consist of probably that pimento cheese I mentioned earlier, in a panini form, sliced into little bites and served with some cold Veuve Clicquot champagne, because Patrick knows that's my favorite champagne. And what else, Patrick? You were going to cook, what, maybe lamb chops?
Lamb chops, for sure. And let's see. Gosh, I'll have to go back to the book.
I think some grilled vegetables were on that menu, and definitely a bottle of Ridge wine. And we'd just have some chocolate and fruit and coffee for dessert. It would be a very enjoyable meal, and the coffee would be caffeinated, and we would drink all the wine.
I love it.
It would be very much our kind of meal.
That is fantastic. Yeah. Well, once again, we are talking with Deborah Madison and Patrick McFarlane about their new book, What We Eat When We Eat Alone. And I know that, Deborah, you're actually going to be doing a book tour. Patrick, are you going to be joining Deborah on this book tour?
Yes, in San Francisco Bay Area.
Excellent. And I know, Deb, you've got a new website that's kind of, I know the book is on there. It's deborahmadison.com. And it's still under construction, so check back often because there'll be more information coming soon. And if people want to find out where you're going to be, where you're both going to be on this book tour, they can go to booktour.com and find Deborah Madison at booktour.com. And I know that you said that that a lot of these illustrations that Patrick has done, which are really quite lovely, will be available, prints for sale, at deborahmadison.com. And you can also take a look, and you should definitely look at Patrick's website, www.mcfarlaneoil. That's McFarlane, McFarlaneoil.com, McFarlaneoil.com. And hopefully go out and buy the book and find you guys in a city where you're going to be. It's published by Gibbs Smith. Is it out now?
Yes, it is. It's been out for about 2 weeks.
Perfect. And what kind of response are you getting from people?
Oh, we're getting a great response and a very unpredictable, funny response. For example, one person said to me, "I love your new cookbook." And I'm thinking, oh, it's not really a cookbook. It's about people. But she said, "I love your cookbook. It's really helped me just get out of the recipe box. And I feel like I'm cooking so freely and having so much more fun than I ever used to." And then the same day, another person said, "Oh, I'm so glad you didn't write a cookbook. I just love these stories. I bought 5 copies for friends." So, you know, there you have it. I mean, people see what they want to see and what they need, and it's all over the map. But I think people enjoy it because it's such a quirky subject, you know, what we do how we eat when we eat alone and nobody's there to judge or watch, and we can set aside everything we know about food and diet and health and all that stuff, and we just do these things, you know. And believe me, everybody wants to tell you what they eat when they eat alone.
So, and you've also got, I just want to, before we close, I want to add that you've made a little YouTube video around this book called What We Eat When We Eat Alone, and you can watch it on YouTube. There are 2 versions, a long and a short, and we'll try to include these on the website with tags. But I'm sure if you Google YouTube and what we eat when we eat alone, you're going to find both of these videos. And you've also got a Facebook page, What We Eat When We Eat Alone, also. So people can check that out. And again, I'll try to get those tags up on the website so that people can just click and find them easily. So I'd like to thank you both for being here today and wish you the best of luck with the book. It's really entertaining and really intimate look into people's lives. Some you know, a lot of people you won't know. What We Eat When We Eat Alone. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, Edible Communities, and we will be back in just a minute.
No vuelvas a cubrir otro rostro divino que nos brinda el destino para hacernos sufrir.
So this is Kate Manchester. You're listening to Edible Communities on Heritage Radio Network. And we want to give a big shout out to Hearst Ranch for making this show possible. This is our second show. Coming in the coming weeks, you'll be hearing from Marla Camp, who is the publisher of Edible Austin, and Marla will be hosting a show for Edible Communities, as will Deborah Shapiro from Edible Green Mountains. And if you take a look at ediblecommunities.com, there's all kinds of information about our 55 edible communities. And again, we're a mission-driven company, or community, I should say, of local food publications. We're the biggest publisher of food publications in the country right now, local food publications. We've got, on that Edible Communities publication website, you can visit events and look at events, food events that are happening all over the country. We've got Edible Communities is partnering with Eileen Fisher for a tasting event in I think 8 or 9 communities across the country. We've got one in Seattle, Santa Fe, East Bay, Portland. Let's see, we've got the Great American Food and Music Festival. That's in... Where is that? Where is Mountain View? That sounds like California. Mountain View. Gosh, Bobby Flay is going to be there. Live music from Little Feet, Marshall Crenshaw, Jazz Blues, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. Let's see, Food Network's Diners, Drive-Ins, Dives. Guy Fieri will be there. That sounds, yes, that's going to be Mountain View, California. So check out Edible Communities website, our events calendar. Again, you can click on any of our publications. And if you don't see a publication in your community and you are interested, you should definitely email ediblecommunities.com to find out how you can start an edible in your own community. Here in Santa Fe, we are working on our summer issue. That should be out in probably another 3 weeks. We're working on an edible kitchen garden tour that's going to be happening in August. We'll also be doing our event with Eileen Fisher. Eileen Fisher is going to be coming to Santa Fe. So we've got lots and lots and lots going on. We also have a blog called Edible Nation. And that is written by our own Bruce Cole. And Bruce Cole is the publisher of Edible San Francisco. Terrific, terrific blog. It'll keep you up to date on anything food, politics, you name it. We've also got a new blog by our own Tracy Ryder. And Tracy Ryder is the co-founder of Edible Communities. And it's an edible stories where they're testing recipes from all of our edible publications all across the country. We've got recipes. The current recipe up there now is, let's see, by Karen Barker, and it was first published in Fine Cooking, and it's from the pages of Edible Vineyard. It's rhubarb brown sugar crumble from Edible Vineyard. Rhubarb happens to be in season right now all across the country. We've got, let's see, recipes on Meyer lemons. We've got barramundi and lemon butter and all kinds of recipes, ediblecommunities.com. We've got a marketplace in Edible Communities.
Hey, Kate, it's Heidi.
Hi, Heidi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm listening to all the yummy stuff.
Okay, good. Well, Heidi, just to introduce you to our community, Heidi, your last name is Eleftherio, and I love that. But it means freedom in Greek. So
that's
Heidi
right.
Is actually a farmer here in Corrales, New Mexico, and she has a fabulous product called Heidi's Raspberry Jam. Heidi and her brother Doug Findlay farm here in Corrales. And let's see, Corrales is a very, very interesting place. It's a very unique agricultural village farmed by small families that have been living here for generations, like many farmers here in New Mexico. It's located on the western bank of the Rio Grande. It's been farmed since 500 A.D., and it goes all the way back to the ancestors of the present-day Pueblo Indians. And subsequent populations of Spanish, French, and Italian families settled there to raise grapes, apples, livestock. And now Heidi and her brother Doug are raising raspberries. So apparently you guys grew up in Corrales, and how did you get started on what? Why raspberry farming?
Well, I wanted to do a fruit, and well, my favorite berry is raspberries. I feel like of all the berries, I think raspberry is the caviar of all the berries. And I'm not meaning to put down blueberries or blackberries or any other berries, but I personally feel like raspberry flavor is the most awesome berry flavor. My sister had farmed raspberries before, and she moved from that property, and so I started doing raspberries because I love them, and then my brother joined me the following year in doing the farming, and he has really taken over the actual field, all the field operations. So he's doing that, and I'm on the cooking end of it. That's a very simplified version of what we do, but that's sort of our
simplified version. I mean, you guys,
position.
First of all, I just want to let people know that I love Heidi's raspberry jam, and you can visit Heidi's Raspberry. Is it HeidisRaspberryFarm.com or HeidisRaspberry.com?
Yes, that's it. Yeah. And I have on my website, you can find out where I have it. I do have it in a couple other states, so, you know, maybe it's where you are. And I also post different things, like we post our events, like, any special events coming up. We're also on localflavor.com. And you know, we have all of our farmers markets that we attend. We've got all those. So all of our locations and stores are all on the website, as well as being able to order and ship jam anywhere.
Order and ship. So I encourage people, HeidisRaspberryFarm.com, take a visit, take a look. I think that the thing that makes your jam really special, they're hand-selected raspberries. They're grown right here in Corrales, New Mexico. They're made in small batches. You guys are certified organic.
Right.
The jams are delicious, and actually one of my favorite is your red chili jam, which I love to glaze a chicken or a duck with.
It's great. It's great on the barbecue, and it's great, you know, people pour it over cream cheese or goat cheese or brie. It's a very nice, unique flavor, the sweet and the heat. It's a sweet heat is what we call it, but... And then we've also got we've got four different varieties of jam, and they're all, my regular raspberry jam is the base recipe for the other ones. They're all low in sugar. It's all organic, and I do a quick cook method, so it retains its beautiful red color, and it still tastes like fresh berries. I don't boil it to death. So as soon as my pectin kicks in, I get it in jars, so it's got a great flavor. And so because of the low sugar, it's also mostly fruit, and that's what hooks people, and they love it. So the farm is certified organic, and then I had to also become certified organic as a processor to process my jam. So we actually have two different certifications going on, but we feel it's totally worth it, and people do look for that, and it's a great plus for our business. It's a great plus for our farm because it's all organic. We're not spraying any awful chemicals, although I have to say some of the fish emulsion that we spray is really nasty smelling.
It's nasty stuff, but plants love it.
It's great. It's a beautiful little farm.
And it's also, I know you guys do, you pick raspberries on Saturdays and Sundays, is that right, in August and September?
That's correct. When we're in season, which... our raspberries come into full season all during August and September. And we have we open the field to the public 9 to 3, Saturdays and Sundays, unless for some reason we can't, and then it just won't be open. But we've had every weekend. It's been a great hit. There's a flock of wild turkeys that wander around and act like they're on payroll, and they strut around and make all the weird turkey noises that turkeys make, which is quite a... quite a wide range, actually.
And you also, you've got hives.
You know, a lot of people bring little kids, grandchildren or their own children, a lot of young families. But, you know, these kids, a lot of them have never been to farms. They don't really know that food comes from farms.
Right.
They think it just comes from the store. So it's exciting for them. They can come out and they can actually go and eat while they're out in the field. And it's a whole experience. So it's a lot of fun. And there's just not that many U-Pick farms in New Mexico. I know
right.
there are in pretty much all the other states, but not here. So it's been good. And the type of raspberries that we're using, that we're growing, we've got four different varieties, but we have what's called an everbearing, and it's also called a primacane.
Mm-hmm.
And these are better for farming because you get a continuous crop. You pick, and it keeps coming on. So it just keeps going until it freezes. So we've got, it's called late summer also. If you're someone who ever got to go out and pick wild raspberries, and they're wonderful and incredible flavor, those are called floricanes, and they're a summer bearing. They all bloom in the early summer. They have their fruit. You pick it, and it's done, and that's it. And as a farmer, we can't do that. It's just not economical for us.
Mm-hmm.
We've chosen the everbearing.
So I guess one thing I want to alert people to also is that, you know, we have an ongoing drought here in the Southwest. And
yes.
So what you're doing is actually really amazing. And to be able to provide a product, a consistent product, and, you know, to provide your purveyors with this product, I mean, you've really got to be smart about water. And we, most of New Mexico operates under the acequia system,
yes.
Which is a very, very old system for allocating water to farms here in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you guys are now using drip irrigation, which is much more efficient. So you've actually made amendments over the years to become more efficient and, I guess,
there's about 6 acres that are planted, and they're on 10-foot center rows. That means, you know, 10-foot from center to center of rows, so we can drive the tractor in between. We've now gone to having a cover crop because basically when we first started, we did flood irrigate as well just to soak the ground well, but now we just irrigate in the beginning to get our cover crop going, which is mostly clover. The clover helps retain nitrogen and create nitrogen for the soil, as
uh-huh.
well as, because it's a heavy clay soil, when that field is flooded, you cannot walk in it. You will lose your shoes in the mud. So it's really nice to have the green in between. It makes it easier when it's wet. But the rest of the time, we are strictly drip irrigating because we don't really want to water all the weeds in between and,
mm-hmm.
and things that can pop up. And the clover stays at a good level throughout the summer, so it's manageable.
Right. So we're talking with Heidi Elefiru of Heidi's Raspberry Farm. That's heidisraspberryfarm.com here in Corrales, New Mexico. And if you've never, if you're a fan of raspberry jam, I would say go ahead and order some jars from raspberry. You're in for a treat. Don't forget the red chili jam. You've also got a ginger jam. Tell me about all of your products.
Well, the four types of jam I started to say was the raspberry, just the plain raspberry. Then we took
uh-huh.
that recipe and we've added a fresh ginger to it. And then we've got the red chili, as you mentioned, and our last one we call it the combo. It's got the chili and the ginger, and it's fabulous on the grill. It's just great because the ginger just boosts the chili, and it's a wonderful combination. It's really common in Thai food to have ginger and chili. Of course, it's
mm-hmm.
totally different in raspberries, but it's still got this great combination. And our, of course, all our ingredients have to be certified organic. So we are in the desert. We're not tropical, and we don't grow ginger here. And so I get my ginger from a little organic family farm in Kauai, Hawaii. And they send me great ginger, just beautiful, beautiful ginger. And during the month of September, I'm able to order. It's only during the month of September, their baby ginger root,
wow.
which is so fresh and tender. It hasn't even formed skin or the little stringy fibers that you find in most ginger. It's just not there. It's like cutting into a potato or something else.
Wow.
Beautiful ginger, beautiful ginger. So
it sounds delicious. Do you send them
my chili, because I use a crushed red chili.
Uh-huh.
And we don't grow the chili ourselves. There's an old guy down south in New Mexico in a little village called Polvadera, New Mexico, and I don't want to give his age, but he's up there, and he's got his organic chili going, and it's great chili. It's just wonderful. So, and those are my ingredients and the sugar, and that's about it. So.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
we did
make some raspberry syrup on the side for snow cones for the farmers markets last year, and they were a huge hit. So we're trying to come up with some new products throughout the winter, because that's the best time for us to try to do new projects, because starting in the spring, we're pretty much slammed until it freezes. With farmers markets, the farming, the cooking, the marketing, the selling, the whole thing, so...
Well, Heidi, I want to thank you very much. And again, mention your website. It's www.heidisraspberryfarm.com. Heidi's Raspberry Jam, Heidi's Raspberry Ginger Jam, Raspberry Red Chili Jam, and Raspberry Red Chili Ginger Jam. Check it out. If you've never had it, you can order it on the web. Or if you're here in New Mexico, you can look under Heidi's website and look at the locations. She's at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. Actually, your brother Doug is there. I see him mm-hmm. often, Doug Findlay. And
that's
Doug
right.
grows your raspberries. Santa Fe Farmers Market, Albuquerque Downtown Market, Corrales Market, Los Alamos, Los Ranchos, and Bernalillo. You can find Heidi's Raspberry Farm products in stores in New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, Arizona, and, of course, on the web. Heidi, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Kate, for having me. It was great. It's a great pleasure, and I'm happy to hear about this radio station.
Now don't you worry.
You've been listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Kate Manchester of Edible Communities. I'm the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, and we'll be coming to you live every Monday at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. You can find clips from the show and everything we talked about on the web at heritageradionetwork.com. We'd like to thank Hearst Foods for making this show possible, Hearst Ranch, that is, for making this show possible today. And today we were talking with Deborah Madison and her husband, Patrick McFarlane, about their book, What We Eat When We Eat Alone. That's by Gibbs Smith Publishing. And you can find out more information about the book and where to find it at www.deborahmadison.com. You can also look at her husband, Patrick McFarlane's paintings at McFarlaneOil.com. That's McFarlaneOil.com, McFarlaneOil.com. And we also talked with Heidi Eleftheriou of Heidi's Raspberry Jam. You can find out more about Heidi at www.heidisraspberryfarm.com. And again, check out ediblecommunities.com, and you can learn more about our community. And in coming weeks, we'll have several other publishers hosting radio shows, Marla Camp of Edible Austin and Deborah Shapiro, Edible Green Mountains. Join us next week. I'll be talking with Deirdre Heeken and her husband, Caleb. They're the authors of Libation, A Bitter Alchemy, and also In Late Winter, We Ate Pears. So tune in every week, and we encourage you to send us your comments. Once the show gets rolling, we'll have a little block of time at the end where we'll take live calls from listeners. And we encourage you to call in or email me directly, Kate@ediblesantafe.com. Again, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, Kate Manchester for Edible Communities. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.